Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. 275 euros each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai 3600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tier restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death. And the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in. And they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With the name of martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Hajj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proof to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism reaching its peak.
The hadaf behind martyr Soleimani is a first in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as Ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif al-Wash, Ali, Sana'a.
Vienna pays tribute to the victims of Monday's terror attack carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terrorist group.
It's a really tense situation, something we never had before in Vienna. So Vienna was always a really secure place and we felt really safe and protected, and suddenly, well, out of nowhere this comes. I'm living nearby. And hearing this was really shocking.
As the nation tries to come to grips with the terrifying shooting, news has emerged of serious mishaps in the run-up to the crime.
Austria's interior minister confirmed the country did have intelligence that the gunman had travelled to Slovakia in search of ammunition in July. Apparently, a crucial tip was not followed up. Karl Nehammer admitted to official errors.
Something obviously went wrong in our communications. An independent commission of inquiry has been set up.
In Parliament, his predecessor from the right-wing FPÖ party called for the minister's resignation. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called for more decisive action at the EU level against what he termed political Islam. Earlier, he'd made it clear the attack should not be seen as a conflict between Christians and Muslims. Experts believe if the correct attributions are not made, it could trigger cultural wars in society.
If you define terrorism, it's the use of force against civilians in order to create fear for political purposes. So that's terrorism. That doesn't have, this definition doesn't have much to do with religion. So it's not necessary to call it Islamic or Islamist terror.
The 20-year-old gunman, an Austrian with North Macedonian roots, had been released from prison in December. Apparently, he misled the government's so-called de-radicalization program. The main worry now is how Europe is going to deal with what experts describe as the growing threat of homegrown terrorism. Homolinski, Vienna.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed two of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves.
There is a verse in the Quran, Surah 48, verse 29, that says, Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and those with him are firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves. In the Battle of Ahzab, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, entered into negotiations with the enemy. But it was not usual negotiations. The details of these negotiations are recorded in history. Battles and negotiations were both carried out in a solid manner. Cooperation was also carried out firmly. That is the meaning of the phrase firm against the disbelievers. The phrase compassionate among themselves means that Muslims are lenient with one another. Muslims do not treat each other firmly. It is time for expressing affections when Muslims are together.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The resistance at the beginning of Baysat resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shaybe Abi Talib. They lived in the sizzling sun in a valley near Mecca for 3 years. There were no plants and no water, and this is no joke. The Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, Abi Talib, Khadija, and all Muslims and their families lived in this valley, in the holes of the mountains. They had blocked all the ways so that they had no access to foodstuff. Sometimes, when it was time for Hajj, in which according to the rules of the ignorance era, no one was allowed to start a war, they were allowed to enter the town. But Abu Jahl, Abu Lahab, and other chiefs of Mecca had told their servants and children to pay twice the price and buy whatever the early Muslims needed to buy. They had been told to prevent Muslims from buying their requirements at a shop. It is no joke living in such difficult conditions for 3 years. It is such resistance and the heart that relies on Allah that gives rise to such solidity and makes people be patient.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
the debate.
The U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to concede power has sparked transition sabotage fears. Leaders on the world stage have also been on the loss as to whether to congratulate the president-elect Joe Biden or not. In this edition of the debate, we will look at Joe Biden's foreign policy directives and scrutinize how world leaders have reacted to his election and whether, based on this reaction, there will be inroads against Trump's previous decisions. First, let's cross on over to Miami. Our correspondent Ronnie Carvello joins us to get an update on America and Americans. Ronnie Carvello, Miami is Florida is the place that Trump won. What type of mood is there prevailing there right now? And how do people? What do people think about Trump's moves to press forward with pressing his election fraud claims and trying to get something out of that?
Well, in Florida, nobody talks about elections anymore. It's part of the past. I can't say that it's a topic, at least it's a top topic of discussion in the state of Florida. Now, the Floridians are letters, spectators, waiting for what happens. Of course, that a lot of can happen and nothing can happen at the same time. Because, as you know, as you just said, that Donald Trump is not a second. What the media has said that he lost the election and the president-elect is Biden, despite many, I have a big list here of senators, governors, former governors, even former presidents from the Republican Party congratulating and accepting the victory of Biden. But nothing can happen, actually. I'll say that Trump, he has until January 20, in order to accept leaving the House, the White House. Because as you know, by December 11 is when the county needs to stop. December 14 is when the delegates, the electoral delegates, need to cast the vote. And then on January 6, on a mixed session between Senate and the Congress, the lower house, need to count the votes and declare the winner. After that is when is officially Biden or not, as right now Biden, will be elected the elected president. So far only the media with the tradition is nothing new. It's something that we are used to that the media is the one who declares the president when they find out that there is no way that the other candidate can surpass the numbers of electoral votes. And then on the noon, 12 o'clock noon on January 20, is the time where Donald Trump must have to leave the House, the White House. And then after that, if he insists to continue the White House, then comes other measures that we don't know that because never happened. So it'll be the first time something so weird happened in this in the United States.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. Ronnie Carvello there talking to us, a correspondent from Miami. Let me introduce Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who joins us from New York. Ian Williams, welcome. So you're there in New York, and we're looking at somewhat of uncharted territory here. There should be an acknowledgement of the U.S. president-elect, but yet you're not getting that in the way that it should from the opposing party, and that would be the Republicans. What are your views, first of all, as to how this has gone down and transpired?
I don't think it's over till the bat golfer sings. I really don't. I think he is a person of infinite resource and cunning and tenacity, and he will try to hang on under all circumstances. The thing now is he's on his own. He was always a one-man band. He was a unique character in that sense. And most of his allies are changing their minds. They are realizing that how bad it will make them look. The rest of the world, the allies, are beginning to accept and acknowledge Biden, and they're really not going to go in the face of it because it was a marginal thing, but Biden was clearly ahead in the popular vote, in the vote on the day, and all of the various counts. Not all of Trump's bluster couldn't alter that, and he concentrated on sort of denying and denigrating the incoming postal votes, which didn't make him look too good because he votes by post as well. But they wouldn't have made the difference in the end. So I think that was what turned it. If they thought there was a chance, they were joining him in frustrating the election and causing chaos. I don't think they think there's a chance, so they're not going to do it. But it's interesting to see the tone. I'm getting 4 emails an hour almost since Saturday, inviting me to contribute towards the fight back, the defend democracy, the defend our votes campaign from the Trump camp. And it's interesting, until Friday night, they were basically enumerating why they wanted you to and what they were accusing the Democrats of. But since Saturday morning, they haven't said what it is they're defending. They haven't said what it is they're accusing the Democrats of doing. They're saying radical leftist Democrats are trying to steal the election. They don't say how, they don't say what, but they're asking for money. And if you burrow down onto the donations, it says 50% of that money will go towards retiring Trump's campaign debt, and the rest will go. They haven't got the lawyers lined up, and so they can't even spend the 50%. I mean, Giuliani is cheap and comes cheap. They don't have to raise a lot of money to get Giuliani. He does it for free because he gets a free song out of being abused, I think. But the other lawyers they get they know that Trump bilks people. They know that Trump will not pay them as he inevitably loses. Uh-huh. So they're not stepping up. And the campaign debt is a very serious issue for them. He is coming out here, and as far as we know, he has huge business debts. He has huge personal debts. His empire of cards is about to fall down. He owes a lot of money on the campaign, where he spent a lot of money and didn't raise that much. So he's in trouble. And I think maybe his sane half is talking to the other half, and the sane half is saying, let's make all this fuss and raise money, and we can pay off some of the campaign debt. But the other half is genuine. He doesn't really accept that he can lose. All How right. do you explain okay. somebody going to play golf 2 mornings after the loss of an election? Doesn't go to his own press conference. He goes off and plays golf. This either sends a signal of complete disdain to the electorate or a complete disconnect from reality. He really says, well, doesn't worry me. I haven't lost the election. I'm going to go ahead and play golf. So, yours. Is it signaling? It's difficult to tell. This man is completely unpredictable. And, you know, the normal political analyses don't really stand, because we're talking about a very erratic, mentally unstable yes. person.
Now, this is the part that gets kind of tricky and somewhat consequential and somewhat dangerous, based on many who have said that, first of all, there have been threats by Trump supporters in terms of the backlash, that they're going to do this or that, and it's going to involve violence. At the same time, we're looking at a very polarized, obviously, America, and Americans from both sides of the aisle here are not too keen on each other. And this is where it comes into the dangerous territory. At least it seems that way. Is there a chance that this is going to lead down that path, where you have Trump supporters and Biden supporters perhaps clashing, where there have been some instances of that happening already?
I was very worried about this on Friday and Saturday. I think the moment has passed. If he can't raise the, you know, if he can't get the peasants out there with their pitchforks and torches on the Saturday and Sunday when this all happened, I don't think he's going to do it today. And the lackluster press conference that the state managed by Giuliani is not going to inspire anybody. Okay. Devoted supporters must be scratching their heads and saying, okay, well, they've stolen it fair and square now, and there's not much we can do about it. But right. I still have that saving reservation. This man is totally erratic, and there's no telling what he might do. And some of his supporters are clearly dingbat crazy, and there's no telling what they will do if they're odd.
All right, great. Let me bring in Scott Bennett. Scott Bennett is joining us from San Francisco, political analyst. Scott Bennett, welcome. Let's move on now. We're going to find out, obviously, what Trump is going to be up to soon.
Good to be with you.
Let's move on to some foreign policy initiatives that perhaps can come into play. When we take a look at Iran, Iran has come out and said, obviously, there's no possibility on renegotiating the Iran nuclear deal, but Biden and his team have said, based on some news sources, that they are going to seek to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal within months, which sounds pretty quick. How do you see it?
Well, I think, first of all, Joe Biden has been supported by Bibi Netanyahu now, and Bibi Netanyahu has recognized Biden and Harris as somehow being president and vice president before all of the legal battles and the election votes are counted. I've always prescribed and thought Donald Trump is trying to make a right turn out of the problems that he's fallen into because of poor advisors with regards to Iran, and I don't think he has any intention of engaging in conflict with Iran, and I think it's only a matter of time before he does not make a new deal, not engage in any pressure campaign, but probably will dust off the old Iran deal and enter into a new one. So I don't have any feelings that he's going to be going into a direction of conflict, nor do any of the people that work in the intelligence circles that I've talked with. I would say, however, that, you know, the comments by your other guests calling people dingbat crazy because they don't support a what seems to be increasingly fraudulent, manipulated, ballot harvested election where all of the legal evidence and the witness testimony and the whistleblowers who have been working in these agencies will testify to, and these will be federal crimes that most likely will be prosecuted. I think it's the epitome of arrogance, which typically comes out of the deep state sort of illuminated class of political consultants and academics who've never served in government or been in the military. That's quintessentially characteristic for what this gentleman is trying to say, and I use that term advisedly. I think this is going to be a potential civil war, but not started by the right, not started by Donald Trump supporters, but started by the fanatical lunatic left that have been burning down cities and engaging in some of the worst examples of domestic terrorism ever seen. So it's not the right, it's not Donald Trump supporters, it's the left that carry madness, and the reason they're trying to push Biden in now is to inflate the bubble of their madness so that they can pop it and in that explosion try and launch a civil war in America where Americans will have to defend against dingbat left.
I knew when we got into this debate we couldn't escape this topic at hand, but I got to give obviously Ian Williams a chance to answer back there. Go ahead, Ian Williams.
I pat myself on this program. You have heard me week after week denouncing Joe Biden. You've heard me week after week talking about what scurrilous people the Clintons are. I'm an equal opportunities finger pointer. And when I say dingbats, I say people who turn up armed to the teeth at town halls trying to intimidate voters and officials are dingbat crazy. And I don't care whether they have Trump on their hat or Biden on their hat. It's just I haven't seen many people carrying semi-automatic weapons with Biden stickers on. They've all been Trump supporters. I'm not even saying all Trump supporters are dingbat crazy. I'm saying that a very significant and dangerous proportion of them have been demonstrably crazy.
Who burned down the
cities?
They
turn up on the street waving guns. In fact, a lot of the burning, as we have seen, if you look at the newspapers, if you read the indictments, was far-right people trying to solve problems. But let's get back to the foreign policy. Biden's foreign policy is not that much different from Trump's overall. He supports Israel. The problem is that he supports the loonies in Israel. He supports the Sheldon Adelson and the far-right liquid, the millennialists and the Apocalypse Now people. He wants, as a lot of, let's say, sensible right-wing Zionists do, is a two-state solution, which he knows the Trump deal will negate and make impossible. They also want the Iran nuclear deal because it takes Iran nuclear weapons off the table. That's what sensible Israelis want. That's what Biden wants. And it so happens to coincide with what Iran is saying and what Iran wants and what the rest of the world wants. So here we have a clear distinction between the crazies who have been going along with Trump and foreign policy field and the same rational, connected to reality people, the rest of the world, every other country in the world, and a lot of the significant proportion of the Israeli political class want the Iranian nuclear deal to be reinstated. And the question is, can Biden just take a tip from Trump? I hope he can.
Okay.
And just issue executive decrees reversing what Trump has been doing.
All right, Scott Bennett, so you can have half your question a rebuttal to what Ian Williams there said, and the other half will move to, if you don't mind, I'm going to forge it into one question, about China, who has declined to formally recognize Biden, along with Russia, I must say, in terms of the win. And tell us what you think of Russia and China, how Biden will be dealing with it. Go ahead.
Well, I think China is certainly happy and clapping their hands together in quiet silence, but they have to put up a good front for their token agent who received millions of dollars and their pornography-addicted son who was that agent. So China is really the sleeping giant that is happiest with Joe Biden because he's their puppet. He's their man. There's also been examples of all sorts of new charges and investigations into that. Russia, I think, is really a more of an astute statesman sort of country. So I think they're doing what should be done. And Netanyahu is a traitor, and he's just simply pissed off at Trump because Trump refused to bomb Iran. And that's why Netanyahu is now moving against Trump. But ultimately, it's going to come down to the analysis of the evidence and the facts and the ballots and the supercomputer hammer that naval intelligence people have been telling me have been used for multiple operations overseas, but now we've seen them multiply operated here against the United States domestic elections. So yes, in one sense, it's very ironic that what we've done to other countries has been done to us. Michigan and Wisconsin were winning for Trump, and then suddenly the votes were turned off, the machines were turned off, and then at 4 a.m., 4 hours later, he was hundreds of thousands of votes ahead of Trump. That's impossible. The statistical impossibility of this vote points to the very real probability of a civil war if the left try and do a coup d'etat. So this is why Americans are very, very upset. And ironically, it gives a chance for Iran and other nations that have legitimate grievances against the United States and have legitimate angers against the assassination of General Soleimani and people like that. Iran has been fighting on the right side by defending civilized free people from ISIS and the Wahhabi lunatics. By the way, the Antifa Black Lives Matter manuals on how to sow social chaos and destruction are written in Arabic, not Persian, Arabic, Wahhabi language. That tells you a lot of what the domestic terrorists are. They're not Iranians. They're from the Arabic description. That's why they're written in that language.
Okay.
So I think we're seeing the real issues, and I do have confidence that the legal statutes and systems of the United States are going to prevail, and you are going to see evidence coming out in the next coming weeks which will indicate Donald Trump won the election and it was tried to be fraudulently stolen, at which case the left will go into panic and fury mode, and they'll claim what Rumpelstiltskin, the agent provocateur of the deep state on the other side of the camera, is saying, and that is, oh, the right is stealing this election. No,
right.
The left tried to steal it, they got caught, they got shut down, and now they're going to be imprisoned, and that's why they're running.
Well, you talked about Saudi Arabia, I'm assuming as one of those Arab countries.
Your companion there. For months before the election, the pundits, the academics, the politicians, all said...
I don't want to hear your propaganda. I want to hear a question from the host. Not from you, not your show, the host. So be quiet. Go ahead, sir.
Try to sabotage the U.S. Postal Service.
Ian Williams, for the sake of...
He appointed a saboteur in charge of the
Be quiet, Englishman. Go ahead.
Right up to the end, they were sabotaging the machine, the
okay,
postal service.
Let's move on. I got 2 minutes left.
Specifically,
okay,
to stop postal vote getting in because he knew it would come against
this
him. So he
constantly shouting
statistically a possibility after they start.
All right, we're talking over each other. Let me address this question, Ian Williams, because we're running out of time. Talked about Arabs there, our guest, Scott Bennett. I have to talk about Saudi Arabia. If Iran and the U.S. were to, again, big if, to go back into this JCPOA, how do you think Saudi Arabia would react to this? Because obviously, based on the previous count of how the JCPOA went down, they weren't too happy.
I think America is done with Saudi.
This will be for Ian Williams. I'm sorry, Scott Bennett. Go ahead, Ian Williams. Go ahead.
The Saudis will be very upset by it. They'll be very upset that Trump has gone. It's even possible the Democrats might say to them, excuse me, you can't go around dismembering journalists and putting them through meat grinders. It's an outside possibility. I do believe it really depends to be how... It's difficult to see how it's going to shake down. Because in the end, some combination of Israeli, how should we say, centrist opinion, and the Saudis will work on Biden. I do believe he is committed. Obama's was committed because it was his trademark deal to the JCPOA. So I think that is going to go in, and the Saudis will either decide that they have to accommodate with it, because in the end they've got money, they've got big checks, but they don't have the military, they don't have the diplomatic force that the United States has allowed them to get away with things like this for a while. So I really think that the Biden people will show no compunction at all. The Democrats in general at that level have shown no compunction in going along with bloodthirsty dictators.
Okay.
When it suits political ends. And this is no exception. They'll go along with the Saudis.
Final question to you, Scott Bennett. It won't be a question, just your views in less than a minute. Go ahead.
Well, I think Biden is a puppet and really a dead man walking who doesn't have any of the mental clarity required of a president. And there's even been cases where his right earlobe in previous pictures is different than the one that appeared at the debate, which many in the Navy intel circles are saying there's an imposter, there's a body double. Why? Because he's mentally gone and he's easy to be replaced. If he did get in, and I don't think he would, I think it would be a civil war, but if he did, for the sake of argument, they would immediately replace him with Kamala Harris and probably try and appoint Gavin Newsom as vice president and go down a road of socialism, Green New Deal, authoritarianism, mandatory mask wearing, confiscation of guns, and all of that would lead America into a 1776-type revolution. I don't think
Fine.
That'll be the
we're
case.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for that. Ronnie Carvello spoke to us from Miami, political analyst, listening there to Scott Bennett, and senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus in Williams. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitalis, goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Boris Johnson's government is investing only 12% of the funds needed to tackle the climate emergency and the growing threat to nature. according to a new report that will raise fresh international concerns about the United Kingdom's commitment to the Green Agenda. The study, released before an expected major speech on the environment by Boris Johnson, says ministers need to commit £33 billion each year of this parliament to green causes. So far, only £4 billion a year has been pledged. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Toby Helm and Robin McKee. The piece is titled Global Experts Question UK's Commitment to Tackle the Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm and Robin McKee's article. Johnson's government is investing only 12% of the funds needed to tackle the climate emergency and the growing threat to nature, according to a new report that will raise fresh international concerns about the United Kingdom's commitment to the Green Agenda. The study, released before an expected major speech on the environment by Boris Johnson, says ministers need to commit £33 billion each year of this parliament to green causes. So far, only £4 billion a year has been pledged. The report by the IPPR think tank comes as Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces increasing global pressure to act, most notably from the next US President, Joe Biden, who is committed to green causes. Donald Trump took the US out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, but Biden has promised to rejoin it on 20th of January, the day he takes power. Next year, the United Kingdom will chair the Glasgow COP26 Climate Change Summit. It is seen by Biden and other leaders as a critical test of the world's determination to limit global warming. However, experts are concerned by what they see as the United Kingdom's lack of preparation, particularly since the COVID-19 pandemic, which has placed huge financial burdens on governments. Carsten Jung, IPPR's senior economist, said, "So far, only about a tenth of funds needed for the clean investment revolution has been made available. Scaling up investment and following the 10-point action plan can create up to 1.6 million jobs and bring economic opportunity to every corner of the country, whilst lowering carbon emissions and restoring nature and tackling inequality." In addition, the government's own Climate Change Committee recently warned that the United Kingdom is not on track to meet its interim emissions target for the fourth and fifth carbon budgets for the periods 2023 to 2027 and 2028 to 2032. The report also identified some critical areas for action. These would include bringing forward the 2035 ban on sales of new petrol, diesel and hybrid cars, an increase in strategic investments in the development of carbon capture and storage for industries such as steel, and much more investment in zero-carbon alternatives to gas central heating. Without these measures, analysts warn, there is a danger the United Kingdom's net zero carbon target will not look credible, undermining its authority as COP26 host. For his part, Boris Johnson has promised to put a green economic recovery at the heart of his government's post-COVID planning, with pledges to boost greatly offshore wind investment. But in September, it emerged that the European Union-China climate talks, which were credited with helping to secure a breakthrough from Beijing, were attended by senior politicians from across Europe, but not the United Kingdom. The European Commission has called for the European Union to raise its 2030 target for emission cuts from 40% to 55%, compared with 1990 levels. China too announced it would set a net zero target for the first time to shift the world's biggest economy onto a greener path. Taken together, these moves have hugely raised expectations for the COP26 conference in Glasgow. Climate scientists have said if enacted, China's new target alone would reduce global warming levels by 0.3 degrees Celsius. By contrast, the United Kingdom has not yet announced any new 2030 target, but there are expectations that Boris Johnson may do so soon. This week, Johnson will announce details of his 10-point plan, including a repeat of his pledge to make the United Kingdom the Saudi Arabia of offshore wind. It will also highlight the importance of conserving and expanding forests to cut carbon dioxide and help wildlife. He's also expected to signal more support for the hydrogen economy to replace fossil fuels in steel and chemical manufacturing, and carbon capture and storage technology to capture industrial emissions. It is also likely that he will call for measures to speed up the development of zero-carbon alternatives to gas central heating, and possibly announce the creation of an investment bank to provide public funding to build zero-carbon infrastructure. For its part, the IPPR think tank urges government to do more in several areas, including improving the energy efficiency of homes and buildings, preparing them for a switch to low-carbon heating systems, and building new zero-carbon social housing, which could generate 560,000 jobs. Its estimates suggest an additional £8 billion annually is needed to achieve the decarbonisation of existing homes and buildings. On nature restoration, it says an investment of £4.7 billion is needed annually through schemes such as tree planting and peatland restoration across the country. This could also create 46,000 new jobs. In addition, it urges more sustainable public transport, including rail and electric bus services, could generate more than 230,000 jobs, whilst installing electric vehicles charging point nationwide could create 47,000 new jobs. Luke Murphy, IPPR Associate Director, said, in announcing the government's 10-point plan, the Prime Minister must significantly raise both the United Kingdom's ambitions and targets on climate and nature, and radically scale up the policies and investments needed to achieve them.